Hello, this is Leslie Garfitenzer, and this is Law to Fact. Today I'm speaking with my former law student and criminal defense attorney, Manai Tavari, about his experience, particularly his work on a murder case, which is the subject of the new HBO documentary, Who Killed Garrick Phillips? In this episode, I speak to my former law student, Manai Tavari. Mr. Tavari is a criminal defense attorney in Queens, New York. Prior to practicing in his own law firm, he worked for Legal Aid. As a new attorney, Mr. Tavari found himself in the middle of a very personal legal fight. Police in upstate New York charged one of his closest friends for the murder of a 12-year-old son of a former girlfriend. The legal challenges that followed were remarkable, both the racial bias that grew from the case and many other constitutional violations. The case was of such import and interest that it is now the subject of an HBO documentary called Who Killed Garrick Phillips, airing tonight and tomorrow night on HBO. This discussion is interesting and insightful and honestly a true high point for me. Before my discussion with Mr. Tavari, I want to remind you that this and all of our episodes are available on any podcast platform and on our website, www.lawtofact.com. You can hear episodes on substantive issues, career advice, and skills necessary for law school success. This and all of our episodes are free, and all that we ask in return is that you like us, subscribe to us, rate us on any of the platforms on which you're listening to this podcast. Your feedback helps us move forward. Here's my discussion with Manai Tavari about his experience representing an innocent man, which is the subject of the upcoming documentary, Who Killed Garrick Phillips?, airing tonight and tomorrow night on HBO, and will be available on HBO Go. So let's talk first about the fact that you have, there's a documentary coming out about a case that you worked on called Who Killed Garrick Phillips? It's produced, directed, I should say, by Liz Garbus, right?
Correct. Her and Sheila Nevins also produced it.
And it'll be on HBO starting July 23rd. So I'm really happy to speak with you. You were my student. How many years ago has it been since you graduated?
Indeed. It's been a while. It's almost a decade. Almost a decade.
Oh,
but you and Professor Westerman Anderson, you know, you guys taught me all I knew. So I used a lot of those skills to help out Mr. Hillary.
Wow. All right. So tell us a little bit about this story and Nick Hillary. And tell us also how you got involved in the case.
Okay. Well, first of all, I met Hillary back in 1996. He helped to recruit me to go up to St. Lawrence University, where we both played soccer and won a national championship. Fast forward down the road, I became an attorney. He became a soccer coach at Clarkson University. Mm-hmm. And starting in 2010, so about a year before the murder, Mr. Hillary started contacting me, telling me about problems he's having with the local police officers. He was dating the girlfriend of a deputy sheriff, and he was being threatened.
Tandy Cyrus was
correct.
Was dated the deputy sheriff. They broke up, and then Tandy Cyrus started dating Nick Hillary, correct?
That is correct,
okay,
yes.
Okay.
Right after that, the deputy sheriff started acting in ways that were just outright scary. He showed up at Nick's house 5 o'clock in the morning, threatening to kick his door in if he's ever messing with his girl.
Mm-hmm.
He started sending threatening text messages and showing up at the home of both Nick Hillary and Tandy Cyrus. It got so bad that Tandy Cyrus actually wrote complaints, four separate complaints, and sent it out to his bosses, the head of the county, saying, quote, she fears for her safety and the safety of her sons.
Well, and let's make clear that Tandy Cyrus and the sheriff were both white, and Nick Hillary is Jamaican African American.
Correct. So from the outset, the only two people in this entire story who are black would be me and Mr. Hillary. St. Lawrence is a very, is 95% white town. It's the largest county in the state, but it's very sparse. It's not highly populated. And besides the four universities that are there, there's not much going on as far as the economy and getting jobs in the town. So it's not a very educated population.
Got it.
So that's the issue that we have there. And that's why ignorance spreads so quickly. But to get back to the story, Mr. Hillary wrote letters of complaints. Tandy Cyrus wrote letters of complaints. Later on, fast forward 1 year, Mr. Hillary and Ms. Cyrus were no longer dating, but they were still very good friends. Mr. Hillary helped to move her into her new apartment.
Mm-hmm.
The Tandy's son, Garrett Phillips, who was a 12-year-old boy, dies mysteriously on a rainy Monday night. Mm-hmm. About an hour and a half after Garrett Phillip dies, police are at Nick Hillary's door knocking, saying that they're giving him a death notification, although we believe that was just coming there to basically get him to talk, to see how they can frame him for this murder. Mm-hmm. And Nick called me and told me that, and as soon as he called me, I understood what was going on. I was a lawyer. I had been a defense lawyer at that point for 2 years. And once he told me what was happening, and also knowing the history of his relationship with the police in St. Lawrence County, I knew immediately that he was about to be framed for murder.
Wow. Wow. And they did indeed frame him for murder, right?
Yes, they did.
They tried.
Yes, they definitely they gave it a good shot. They gave it a good shot. 2 days after the murder happened, Mr. Hillary was brought to the police station under the false belief that police told him they wanted him to assist with the investigation and look over the names of some children that Garrett went to school with. Mm-hmm. Hillary and I spoke just before that. When he went there, they tried to trap him into a confession, and he invoked his Sixth Amendment. As you will see in the movie, the police were a little bit confused when he invoked his Sixth Amendment because they did not understand that a Sixth Amendment means a right to counsel. So they were confused as to what he was asking, the Sixth Amendment, not the Fifth. He would not speak to them.
That's smart. And that's interesting, too. I mean, I will finish telling the story, but I do want to talk a little bit to how uninformed the police were about constitutional rights.
Correct.
Even though they're, you know, we think like the police will know what's going on and they will be proper in their use of constitutional rights, but they actually are not. They don't go to law school and they don't really know what rights one has and what rights one doesn't.
Yes, and it's important for your law students to understand. That's why first year of law school and getting that constitutional law class with Professor Gershman is so important, because the constitutional rights that you have, and specifically year 4, 5, and 6, Mr. Hillary and I are talking about really teaching that, because the police don't know it. And not only don't they know it, but it's not really important to save their lives, but it's important to save yours. So. Mm-hmm. That's why you have to learn that. And if, when you're in law school, you understand how important these rights are, but understanding them, if you don't exercise them, it doesn't help you.
And so, do you as an attorney know, I mean, even before this, that the police don't know constitutional rights? Is that something that lawyers need to be aware of, is the misinformation that may be handed down? And it's not necessarily malicious. Sometimes it just could be, you know, benign, but
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this came at a point in my career when I was doing a whole lot of cross-examinations. I was working as a defense lawyer for parolees. Mm-hmm. Parolees don't get good plea offers, so we got to go to trial a lot. So at this point, I was cross-examining police officers basically on a daily basis at Rikers Island. And you learn, some of these guys are good guys, but they did not do a 1L con law class. They don't know the Fourth Amendment. They don't spend 5 weeks studying what it means for a DeBar level 1, level 2, or level 3. They just go out and lock people up. Yeah. The people who are supposed to know these on that side would be the prosecutors and the DAs, who know this, but in our case, even though they knew rights were violated, they were willing to go ahead to get a conviction. Hmm.
So let's go back to the story again. And speaking of the police then take Mr. Hillary into custody, and I believe they strip search him. Am I correct about that?
Correct. That is exactly correct. 2 days after the murder, the police said that they're going to lock somebody up. Mr. Hillary's brought in. He's strip searched, which is totally against the law. And again, they strip searched him in violation of his rights. They had 5 police officers standing there. And it really looked like a scene from a slave trade, watching him parlayed around. It was videotaped. Yeah. It was videotaped, and it will be on the documentary as well. So once you see the documentary, you'll see how he was just just strip searched in order to demean him and to break him down mentally.
Mm-hmm.
What's surprising was that his daughter is his alibi. And when I got there, the police asked me to bring his daughter to the same office that he was strip searched in, and she was 15 at the time. So it shows you their brazenness and just their lack of just common sense to think that as his attorney, I would be willing to have his daughter come and just talk, because that's the same thing they told him, and he was strip searched. So that's another fun fact that wasn't in the documentary, but the police actually requested his alibi, 15-year-old Shanna Kay, who's in the movie, to come down to their station.
Wow. And so,
and of course, we refused.
Yeah, well, good. I mean, and you weren't, I mean, you were not practicing. You had to have been practicing less than 10 years, probably more like 5, right, when this all started?
When this happened, I was practicing for about a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah. I think my training as a historian, more so than my training, as much as my training as a lawyer assisted, because I had known about the Scottsboro Boys, mm-hmm. who brought about the constitutional right to have a defense counsel, who is actually engaged and who is trying to fight for you. That's a case of young black boys in the 30s, I believe, who were basically framed.
Yeah.
We know about the Central Park Five,
yeah.
Who are young men who were basically railroaded through the system. So knowing that, you know, black people normally don't get a fair shake, I wasn't surprised by what they did. So by not being surprised, I was ready to act in the ways we needed to act.
Yeah, you were smart. And speaking of that, and one of the things I think that's most interesting, we've had a chance to chat about this a little bit beforehand, is that you brought the case to the press, right?
Yes, I was able, against the advice of many lawyers, to get this thing some press coverage. And my reason for that, I didn't do that lightly. My reason for that was, if this thing went the wrong way, and if they were successful in framing him, we wanted to have a bullhorn and we wanted to scream that this was a lynching as much as possible. And also, I knew that when people are doing evil, they don't want to do it in the light of day. They'd rather do it at night.
Right.
And since sunlight is the best disinfectant, I reached out to ESPN, the New York Times, every single radio station we could get in front of. We got in front of, and we made his case known. What helped us to do that was because previously, before he was charged, we did a civil lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that civil lawsuit, we got the entire police file. And the police file was what proved to us in black and white, and proved to the press and everybody else that he was being framed.
So let me just go through the timeline a little bit. That they brought him in, they strip searched him. You then brought a civil rights case, which is a civil case, saying that
correct.
The police treated me, or treated Mr. Hillary, I shouldn't say me, but treated Mr. Hillary unfairly. That is a civil standard case. And then
correct.
After
it's a 1983 case.
Right.
So we against sued for Fourth Amendment violations, Sixth Amendment violations, and also defamation,
mm-hmm.
because the police were going around town telling everyone that Nick's a murderer.
And wow. What happened with that case?
Well, that case survived summary judgment,
mm-hmm.
And it was scheduled for trial. However, after the acquittal, Mr. Hillary then also did a malicious prosecution case. So our initial action was stayed and waiting to join that second one.
Right. Oh, so it's, and that's the point I'm making, is that after you brought this civil action, then they charged him with murder, correct?
Correct. Because what they this was corruption on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
They understood when we did the civil rights case and when we received all the material, they understood that we would also discover that, although we knew before it was a frame job. So before the judge came back with a decision
mm-hmm.
in favor of Mr. Hillary,
mm-hmm.
they understood that they would have to charge him quickly.
Wow.
Which is what they did.
Right.
They charged him the very same day that the first day that the judge on the civil case was able to return a decision was the day he was charged.
And why did they have to charge him quickly? Why was that important?
Again, the judge had come out with his decision in the civil rights case that we filed, stating that the case would go to trial. Had that decision come out about the strip search and the judge actually finding a fact of what happened, I think politically it would have been more difficult to charge him.
see.
However, by charging him early and by poisoning the mind of the public, they were able to pretty much convince people while trying to keep the facts of the civil case hidden that Mr. Hillary had something to do with this. Hmm. And as you will see in the documentary, there were no facts. So they basically told the public what they wanted to know and hid the truth from the press and the public.
And I should remind everyone, the documentary again is on HBO and it's on starting July 23rd for 2 nights, Who Killed Garrett Phillips? And it'll probably be on HBO On Demand and HBO Go and all of that after that.
Yes, so, that is correct.
Yes. My student's moment of fame. So this is so interesting and I'm so proud of you. I always knew you were going to be a superstar, but let's go back to you graduated from law school. And what was the first job you had out of law school?
The first job was working as a parole lawyer for the Legal Aid Society.
Were you in the Bronx or where were you?
I was in Manhattan, but I was at Rikers Island every day. Our office was in Manhattan, but the actual job was at Rikers Island in the trailer where the soldiers for the Civil War used to stay in the 1860s. I'm sorry.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
So Rikers Island used to be a military base for black soldiers during the Civil War. And now it's a prison. And being the historian I am, I worked there for about 3 years.
Wow, that's interesting. And then, so this case came while you were working there. And then when did you leave Legal Aid?
I left Legal Aid basically in the middle or right after the acquittal. Mm-hmm. I started my own practice, which I have now. And I do criminal defense in Queens for the most part. Mm-hmm. I'm also still a public defender in that I work for QLA, who mm-hmm. have a hybrid public defense slash private defense as well.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. And so going back to law school, we're just going to work our way backwards here, Manai. Going back to law school, I know that you took a lot of criminal law, criminal defense type of cases. And I'm going to speak for you by saying that you kind of went to law school knowing what you wanted to do because you took some time off between law school and
undergraduate.
Which, by the way, I think is very important to take some time off between undergraduate school and law school. I mean, would you agree with that?
I definitely would. Although I might be biased. My wife took about 3 years off and I took 5. But you come back knowing what you want to do. You come back understanding. And I was a 3L and I was still pinching myself like, oh, my God, I'm in law school, because you really feel proud of this profession and you understand how important it is and mm-hmm. what kind of change you can make in the world. So I think taking that time off, getting a real respect for the profession and appreciating what we can do helped me at least in my career.
And what did you do between law school, undergrad and law school?
I was a fund accountant.
Okay, there you go. And I think you could be a bartender. I just think taking the time off, clearing your head from that undergraduate head, and also realizing you're going for a profession that's going to give you kind of this key to spending your life doing something of, you know, so valuable is really helpful, regardless of what you do in between.
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, there's so many great lawyers out there and so many people to be inspired by. And like for me, it was my, you know, professors like yourself. It was looking out there and seeing the civil rights lawyers. It was just seeing people who took their law degree and did more than just make money off it, but just, you know, really change the world, which I think hopefully this case can do as well.
Oh, it definitely will. And we'll get back to the case, but just I have a couple more questions first. One is, what would you recommend for students who are going to law school knowing they want to be public defenders or even that they want to be prosecutors? Should they only take criminal law classes once they're after they finish their first year?
No, I would broaden the classes that I take if I were to do it all over again. Mm-hmm. You know, Pace had always been a great environmental law school, and I wish I took advantage of that, but I didn't. And now, you know, issues of the environment are so prevalent every day. And, you know, if you understand the problems, you can also understand the solutions. So classes like that, family law. When you get out here, the real world, you see how important classes like family law is. Don't just cram when you're at studying for the bar. Try to get your hands dirty and take it. And if you want to be a prosecutor or a defense attorney, as your students know, just go sit in an arraignment room in any court, whether it's in White Plains or whether it's in Queens or the Bronx. Just walk in, go through the metal detectors and sit down and see lawyers practice, listen to bail applications, listen to the things people say when they should really be staying silent and how that's used against them later. And talk to some lawyers where they're working overnight. They love to talk to law students. But these are the things you could do to get that practical experience, but still take some extra classes from or great professors in other areas that you might not be as familiar with.
Yeah, I agree to that point, that once you get out, you practice a very narrow area of the law. So the more you can broaden your horizons in law school, it will just make it richer. But I had never thought about just walking into an arraignments room. That's a brilliant, brilliant idea. And you don't need an appointment to do it. You just walk in.
Open to the public. Open to the public. And students don't do that enough. And when you do it, you can see, you know, from your murder case, your arraignment for your murder case. I've seen some really interesting arraignment murder cases. Just, and I'm a lawyer, so you sit in the front, but anyone can come in court, and it just gives you a knowledge base. And knowledge is power. And the more knowledge you have about how it works, you know, you put that together with your technical training you're receiving in class, and that's how you begin to become a lawyer, really.
So when you had your first job and you did your first representation of someone on parole, were you nervous? Did you feel confident? I mean, what do you remember how you felt when you first started?
I did. I was very nervous. I almost poisoned my client my first week. You know, I was talking to a young man about 18 years old, and, you know, I gave him some of the Brazilian nuts I had. It turned out he was allergic to peanuts.
Oh,
so I thought I was going to lose my job within a week. But, you know, these things happen, and you're going to be nervous on your first trial. You're going to be nervous in your first hearing, and it's always going to be baptism by warm water. And mm-hmm. you got to get in there and you got to do it. It's just like law school, putting that paper together. Once you do it and you become more confident, the more you do it, and you just have to really have confidence in yourself and work hard. Those are the two most important things, I think, for an attorney.
Wow, that's good advice. So getting back to Nick Hillery, one of the things that I'm sure is in the documentary, in fact, I know it's in the documentary, is but we didn't get to talk about really quickly, is how you knew him. How did you come to represent Mr. Hillery?
We were friends since way back in high school. He recruited me to play soccer at St. Lawrence. So we won a national championship. We lived together for 3 years. We spoke on the phone every day. He was a coach. I'm an avid soccer fan. Mm-hmm. So this is a friend of mine. This is not necessarily someone who called me on the phone and said, all right, what's the retainer fee? What are we going to do? This was someone in your life who you know. So it's not a situation where, oh, let's get the facts to see if he killed a 12-year-old boy. It was, they're framing my friend and we need to get the facts to show that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And how has participating in this case changed who you are as an attorney?
I think it changed me in two ways. I went to law school because I knew that the system was corrupt. Now I know that even more, and that's really not a good feeling, because it also convinces me that many hundreds, maybe thousands of innocent people are in jail innocently. It's a terrible system we have when you don't have the resources to defend yourself, and when you have people in power who care more about a win than doing the right thing. So the case, I think, affected me in that way, where I really don't have that belief at all in the system at this point. But it also affected me to know that we need young lawyers and people who really care about justice to fight as hard as the people on the other side are fighting, and to become district attorneys when you leave law school, and then weed out the people out of your office who are corrupt and become defense attorneys and fight for your clients. So it made me jaded, but it also inspired me, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes wonderful sense. As you're speaking, I just have to say, it just, I guess, warms my heart, isn't superlative enough to say how proud I am, not just to see how you translated your commitment into justice, but you're really so professional. You're such an advocate of the profession, and you're so committed. It's just, it's everything that a professor wants to see in a law student when they kind of send them into the world. It's just amazing. And you know, from the beginning when you were sending me the clips, they made my day, because there's nothing a professor wants more than to see their students use the skills you taught them in for
Indeed.
success, you know?
Indeed. And you guys definitely did. I tell people, just when I used to go to Pace, I used to come by your office. I used to go by Gershman's office, Professor Gale's, and we wouldn't talk about cases at all or even classes. We would just powwow and talk about issues like this and the need, you know, to change things like this. Pace University sent me to Africa. That was a life-changing thing. So I got to saw, you know, justice and injustice firsthand. To this day, that's the greatest moment of my life, to go to Africa. So, you know, we train our students well, and we train them with a plan for the future. And you guys, I think, did an excellent job, not with me, just me, but with a lot of attorneys. One of the defense attorneys for Mr. Hillary was Mr. Peter Dumas, who's from the class of 1999.
Yeah, I know.
And yeah, he'll tell you about Pace. So, you know, we're putting out good lawyers out there, and we're trying to do the best we can.
Well, thank you. And one of the other takeaways from what you just said is, if you go to law school, no matter what law school you go to, that professors really do want to engage, and that it's perfectly appropriate to speak to a professor. Either you can chat with them at the end of class or make office hour appointments, but you can talk to professors about the law, and it may not be the law that you're studying in class, but we're just happy to talk to you about any of that. We're in the same profession as the one we're training you to be in. So that's a really important takeaway for law students, I think. I do want to ask you one other thing. Talk so much about defense. Can you just tell me your feeling about prosecutors for a moment?
Well, I really think that the prosecutors are the good guys. The system was set up for the prosecutors to be a good guy. And that's why I respect them so much. The defense attorney's role is to defend your client, whoever that client is. So, you know, a guy beats up his wife and stabs her a few times. You're there to defend your client and get him either the best deal he can get or to get him off. That's not justice, but that's your job. The judge is calling balls and strikes. The prosecutor is there to do justice. The prosecutor has to let the innocent guy go, and he has to go after the guilty guy in the right way. So I have loads of respect for prosecutors. The system is set up for prosecutors to be fair-minded, to be some of the best people in the world. And that's why, if you're in law school and you want to make a change, be a good prosecutor. But also, you have a lot of power. So if you're not a good prosecutor, you know, there's a lot of bad you can do as well.
Good point. Good point. So good career options. Well, thank you, Manai. I cannot wait until Tuesday night. Thanks again,
I
Manai.
really appreciate it.
So that's my discussion with Manai Tafari. I encourage you to watch the HBO documentary, Who Killed Garrett Phillips? Let's continue the conversation offline. You can tweet us at Law to Fact, find us on Facebook, or email us at lawtofact@gmail.com. You can also inspire us to create future shows. Send us suggestions about topics or professors with whom you'd like us to speak, and we'll try to meet every request. Thanks again to www.bensound.com for the music, and enjoy your day.